Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Bruce Dantzis. Dantzis attended Cornell University from 1965 to 67, and for many years in the 1960s, he was president and co-chair of Cornell's Students for a Democratic Society, known as SDS. He dropped out of Cornell to become a full-time anti-war and draft resistance organizer and was Cornell's first Vietnam-era draft resister when he tore up his draft card publicly. He spent 19 months in federal prison in Kentucky for draft resistance. He eventually graduated from UC Santa Cruz and Stanford University and had a long career in journalism, working for many magazines and newspapers, including Mother Jones and the Sacramento Bee. He recently published a book about his activism called Resister, a story of protest in prison during the Vietnam War. It was published by Cornell University Press. And I'm speaking to Bruce Dantzis by phone from his home in California. Bruce Dantzis, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I want to begin with December 1966 when you were 18. You stood before a small crowd at Cornell University, tore up your draft card, denounced the Vietnam War. Tell us what your thoughts were at that moment and what brought you to that place.
Well, my thoughts at the moment were that I'm going to jail, and I'm going to jail as soon as I do this.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't happen. My thoughts were, I mean, this was part of a process that took a while to develop for me. You know, I turned against the war, as did many people in 1965, when President Johnson escalated the war by introducing U.S. ground troops in Vietnam, bombing North Vietnam, and all that. When I came to Cornell in the fall '65, I was still only 17. So I didn't turn 18 until the end of my freshman year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was confronted with, what am I going to do about the drafts, as every young man was,
yeah,
you know, at that point. And I felt that the student deferment, which I could have gotten, was just unfair.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I looked at myself. I came from a middle-class family where I was expected to go to college. You know, my parents had the means to provide, you know, me with some financial support to go along with my Regents Scholarship, so I could go to college and thus avoid the draft. Yet a poor kid, you know, who's just as smart and capable as me, didn't have that opportunity, and they would be immediately drafted and most likely go to Vietnam. So I sort of felt that the student deferment was a class privilege, and I just couldn't accept it.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, I wasn't quite ready to make that decisive break with selective service that I assumed would land me in federal prison.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't ready to do that yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I applied for conscientious objector status. But after a while, I found that some of the same problems with being a CO, which I think is an honorable thing for people to do. But one is that you had to be against all war at that point. You couldn't be for select wars or something
right,
like that.
Right.
And at that time, I did believe in nonviolence, and I did consider myself a pacifist. So I could have probably gotten CO status, but I thought it had the same problems that the 2S deferment had, that you had to fill out this very difficult form on your belief on the use of force and wars. Again, it was the kind of thing that I, as a kid, you know, who went to good high schools, was going to Cornell, I could fill out that form. I had excellent draft counselors. And someone else who, again, had the same beliefs as me would have had trouble getting CO status.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
By the middle of my sophomore year in December 66, you know, where you asked me about, I'd come to the point where I just couldn't cooperate with selective service anymore. I mean, I felt that the card was figuratively burning a hole in my pocket.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided that that was the time for me to make a break with selective service. You know, I hoped other people would follow me. I was not into individual witness. I mean, I understand the Quaker tradition, but I felt that this was a political act and a personal act. So it was something I felt that I had to do for myself, for my conscience, but I also hoped it would inspire other people.
Yeah, that was an interesting time. I was following all the anti-draft guys, too, and from California, and joining Another Mother for Peace and doing all that stuff. Now tell us, you became a leader in the Students for a Democratic Society, known as SDS, in 1965.
Right.
What attracted you to SDS? I know it was a new organization at that time on Cornell's campus. Tell us what attracted you.
Sure. Well, what attracted me was that it was a multi-issue organization. There were some just anti-Vietnam War groups on campus, but I felt, you know, I was still a strong believer in civil rights. You know, I was anti-racist. You know, I cared about the U.S. role in the world, not just in Vietnam, but in supporting South Africa. I was already into that issue about being against apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were just so many different issues that one could confront, not just Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And SDS, in addition to being, you know, the first group to hold a nationwide demonstration against the war seemed to really be the one that was trying to organize students, and that was me. I was the target group for them, and I thought I really did believe in what SDS was trying to do.
Yeah, SDS had a lot of interesting fingers in the pot during that era.
It did, and it and changed a lot over the years.
It did. We will talk about that.
Most of us.
Yeah.
Sure.
Now, talk a little bit about your philosophy. You said early in the book that you believed, and early in your career as an activist, that you believed in revolutionary nonviolence. To tell me exactly what you meant by that at that time.
Sure. I guess I was a follower of people like A.J. Mustey and Dave Dellinger, Paul Goodman, civil rights movement, is very much impacted by the civil disobedience in the civil rights movement, which seemed to be still adhering to principles of nonviolence, but by no means being passive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the whole line, passive resistance, was not what I was interested in. I was interested in active resistance. And to me, that meant sometimes putting your body on the line to resist illegitimate authority or to resist unjust laws. So, I mean, to me, the biggest impact probably was seeing young kids in the civil rights movement, you know, black teenagers in the South going up against nonviolently this awesome power of the police, you know, police dogs, fire hoses, you know, getting beaten, sent to jail. And I was starting to think, you know, if they could do this, you know, what am I doing? I mean, I support what they're doing. I'm against discrimination. So, I mean, that was a very big impact on me to say that, yes, if you believe in something, you have to be willing to put your body on the line for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that one could do that without resorting to violence. I mean, I did change my position somewhat over the years, but, I mean, I always felt that people in dissent can never out-militarize the military. You know, you're not going to win fights with the cops.
Right.
They may make you feel good at a certain point, but ultimately, the state does have the power to put down a movement. But what it can't put down are ideas and decency.
Yeah.
And the way to me, the way that you change the country is you change people's minds.
I know, and that's still a philosophy that I still believe in. Now, tell us about the Selective Services and some of their appalling policies. I remember you talk about the fact that a student that had high grades could get a deferment, and then they started doing that special test. Tell us about that. You guys protested Cornell University doing that qualification test. Talk to us about that.
So many students could get deferments and stay out of the Army or the Navy or any of the armed forces, but they were having trouble getting enough manpower to fight in Vietnam. So they instituted something called the Selective Service College Qualification Exam. I love those euphemisms, right? Which basically was a test for people who had poor grades. And if you did well on the test, you could keep your student deferment. But if you did lousy on the test, they could take it away, reclassify you 1A, and draft you.
Oh,
and we thought this was
appalling.
A terrible corruption of what education is about, learning. So this was an obvious thing that a group like SDS should be protesting. And we did. We led a campaign against it on campus, which culminated in a sit-in that SDS had at the President Perkins office at Day Hall at the main administrative building. And I was one of the 7 people who got there fast enough to get inside his office before the campus cops locked the doors. So that was my first brush with, although I had done some activism before for civil rights in high school, that was my first brush where I was actively breaking a rule or a law by doing a sit-in like that. So I ended up getting a reprimand. But this, you know, this is part of the process that moved me towards taking a more militant or more radical position. Yeah, this is happening in like May 66. All those protests.
And I just want to tell my listeners, you've got to read his book and read all about this, because the way you talk about this is totally fascinating. It's like nothing really has changed in some ways either.
Well, I try in my book to include, it is a memoir, but I was trained as an historian, so I do try to provide documentation for what I'm saying, examples. I did a lot of research. I did a lot of interviews with people. But I have some sections in my book which are sort of you are there kind of thing.
Yeah,
so I try to place you in the middle of the action, you know, whether it's that sit-in or something at the Pentagon or in actions I did with Abby Hoffman later or some time in prison, things like that, along with the general history of the movement and myself.
Yeah. You know what, Bruce? You talked about something that I had never heard about, the Security Index. Now, I had never heard about that, where you could detain people indefinitely for a national emergency. It sounds like now.
Yeah, I think these laws first came about, you know, years ago, way before Vietnam, and they affected, I think they were going after Nazi spies and things like that in World War II. was used against that. Then they threatened to use it against communists in the 1950s, and it was sort of revived. And they had a whole bunch of different names. There was a security index. There was a rabble-rouser index. I love that one. I mean, there was an agitator index. These are all things that J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI cooked up to keep an eye on people who they thought were troublemakers.
Oh, God. And yeah, nothing has changed. That's what scared me about your book, you know?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. No, I mean, the security index basically was these are people who should be arrested in a national emergency. You know, which is incredible to me because, you know, I really wasn't. I mean, I wish I was more of a threat to, you know, but you know, to end the war and do that. But we weren't. Our movement was small. We were mostly nonviolent. You know, I mean, but we were being characterized as people trying to bring down the society and all that.
You know what? It was a culture that, you know, the 50s was so placent, and everybody was kind of a conformist with short haircuts, and you know, so they weren't used to seeing anybody really questioning authority. I think that scared them more than anything. Don't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, and we've learned now how hostile J. Edgar Hoover was towards the civil rights movement and towards, you know, Dr. King, trying to get him to quit and disappear from public life by blackmailing him. I mean, there was a whole bunch of stuff going on that it's just incredible that an agency of the U.S. government could be doing that.
Yeah. Now, in this era of high tech and email and stuff, people would be surprised about the Glad Day Press that was started in Ithaca. Tell us about that. It was kind of a submissive thing. They were doing leaflets and anti-war pamphlets. And to talk to us about how kind of submissive that was.
Yeah, it was wonderful. I mean, it started before I ever got to Cornell. It started in the back room of a young couple, Joe and Pat Griffith. I think Joe was a graduate student in physics. I think Pat at first was a housewife, and then she started working with the Inter-University Committee for Debate on Foreign Policy, which is a group of anti-war professors who were holding the first teach-ins. This took place in around 1965 and 66. And they first set up just like a cheap offset printer in their back room. But eventually it got larger. They got the needs of the movement got bigger, and they got an office space, mostly paid for by the contributions of Cornell professors and other, you know, progressive-minded people in Ithaca. It became a place where we printed a lot of anti-war literature, reprinted pamphlets, you know, articles in progressive magazines and things like that. We had our own publications there. I edited a magazine in 67 and 68 called 68 and 69, sorry, called The First Issue. We put out Dateline Ithaca, The New Patriot. A whole bunch of things came out of there. I think African American students were able to use the press to put out some of their literary magazines. So it became this sort of counterculture center for the written word.
Oh, I think it's fascinating. Yeah.
It was wonderful. And in all the years it existed, we never really had a hierarchy. They didn't charge people to do the work. It was all done by donations and mostly volunteer labor. It was an amazing institution, and I'm sad to see it's gone.
Yeah.
When I was in Ithaca the last time, I went by the place. I think it's now, unfortunately, a pizza place. Our last office was at 308 Stewart Avenue, and there's a pizza place there now.
You know, those kinds of presses, it was so innovative, some of the ways people were communicating during that era. Now, of course,
right.
You know, you tore up your draft card and you didn't go immediately to jail, but you did have to pay. So you talk about your arraignment in April of 67 in Syracuse for draft resistance.
Yeah. Well, as I said, you know, I was hoping that my action would lead to or help inspire other people to take similar actions. And I have been part of a group, we called it the Ithaca Draft Resistance Group. When we got together, just on the idea that if any of us were called to go, we would refuse induction and we would all try to support each other. And then I took my action. So then people in the group were saying, well, how do we support Bruce? And they came to the conclusion, which I heartily endorse, that the way you support Bruce is to do the same thing. So we tried to organize out of Ithaca the first mass draft card burning ever, which we were trying to do it in April 1967 to coincide with a planned huge anti-war march called the mobilization in New York. I dropped out of school after I tore my draft card, and I started working for this and working with the Mobilization Committee Against the War, you know, to build this draft card burning. And I was indicted for my own action just less than a week before the draft card burning. And one of the proudest documents I've ever gotten is when I got my FBI file, it included a letter from J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, to the Albany office, saying it's important that Danzis get indicted before the April 15th graft card burning.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bruce Danzis. We're talking about his book, Resistor, a story of protest and prison during the Vietnam War. Go ahead and continue, Bruce, about this big mobilization. And you got indicted right around that time when you were working on that.
Right. Yeah, well, we're basically just a bunch of Cornell students, me, a dropout, and some graduate students trying to organize people all over the country to burn their draft cards in New York City. And so clearly I understand why the government would be worried about that and upset about that. But the timing of my own indictment was just so obviously connected, even before I, years later, got this document showing why it happened then. Mm-hmm. You know, it all seemed to be an attempt to scare people. You know, okay, this is what's going to happen to you if you do what this guy did.
Yeah, and it didn't scare you, though, right?
No, it didn't scare me, no. And later on, I refused induction in 1968. I guess they were worried that the Supreme Court might throw out the law against draft card burning, which is a strange law. If you don't mind, I'm digressing for a second. And this is a law that was passed in 1965 with virtually no dissent in the Senate or the House of Representatives, mm-hmm. which made it illegal to mutilate or destroy or damage your Selective Service card.
God,
incredible,
amazing, isn't it?
You know, they gave this incredible status to this little piece of paper, and young men had to carry it on their person at all times.
I remember.
It's funny, people often ask me, okay, well, you believe it's so important draft card burning, did you believe in burning the American flag? And I always made a distinction between that. I mean, people, you know, view the flag, you know, as a symbol of America, from, you know, and all that. And for many people, it's a cherished symbol and this and that. And I've never thought it made any sense to burn flags. But a draft card, nobody liked the draft card. They thought it was a system that was corrupt. You asked before about what was wrong with the draft. Well, the deferment system, as I mentioned, was really awful, pitting people, you know, those who were wealthier than others.
Before we run out of time, I want to move up to the, you know, so you got indicted, but you were taken to jail for the first time on November 14th, 1968. Talk to us about
right.
how you were feeling at that time.
Well, you know, I was expecting to go to jail at any time after I tore up my draft card. So I was prepared. You know, I had like 2 or 3 years of solid preparation to get myself psychologically, you know, ready for that. So in that sense, I knew, you know, I was surprised when the judge denied bail, you know, when he sentenced me. But I was prepared to go to jail. Fortunately, the appeal court let me out. They said the judge made a mistake. He should have allowed me to have bail. And I was able to stay out another 6 months when finally the Supreme Court ruled with only one dissent from William O. Douglas. You know, the draft card law was, in fact, constitutional. And I went to prison. And I was given a sentence that I hated at the time. It was called the Youth Corrections Act sentence, which they can give to people who are under 25. And it was an indeterminate sentence of 0 to 6 years.
Yeah.
And when you would be paroled would be up to the parole board. So theoretically, if you were rehabilitated in 6 months, 1 year, you could be let out, whereas the crime for tearing up your draft card or burning your draft card was 5 years in prison. But to me, the only way you could get out of prison is that it would be to recant my views and say, okay, I'm willing to carry my card. I'll go to the Army. You know, you can draft me. And I wasn't going to do that. So I thought I could be in prison for even longer than the statute of limitations for the crime.
Mm-hmm.
But as it turned out, the Federal Bureau of Prisons seemed to have an unwritten policy that draft resistors would spend 18 to 20 months in prison, and I did 19 and a half.
So you
turned out all right.
You began your sentence, though, in the Onondaga County Jail in May of 1969. You spent 9 days there, right, before you were taken to the federal prison in Kentucky.
Yeah, that wasn't the most pleasant time in the world. I mean, county jails are often pretty rough. You've got a mixture of guys who are awaiting sentencing, awaiting trial, guys who are about to be sent to another prison. Generally a fairly rough place, but, you know, I got through it okay. I think they were trying to figure out where they were going to send me. And even though there were quite a few prisons that were closer to either Ithaca or New York City, where I was from, than where I ended up, they ended up sending me to Ashland, Kentucky.
Which was a minimum security, right?
Yeah. No, it was actually medium security.
We had gun towers
and barbed wire fences and all that. But It was a youth prison, so it was mostly guys under 25, okay? So luckily for me, and that meant that, how can I describe it? You don't have a lot of guys who are lifers in there or murderers because it's federal, but many guys in for armed robbery of the bank, mail fraud, drugs, very few draft resistors. So it was sort of like it was rough. There were fights all the time, but very few people were getting killed.
Yeah, yeah. You know what I think
to make a distinction.
You know what I think is interesting, that you were sent to prison for tearing up your draft card and not technically for refusing induction, right?
Right.
That is so unbelievable to me.
It was pretty funny trying to tell inmates when they'd ask you, what are you in for? And I said, we're tearing up my draft card. And most guys in prison couldn't believe it, you know. I mean, really? You're in for that?
Yeah. You know? Bruce, tell us what you did, though. I mean, you were able to work as a teacher. You were able to use your education to help other inmates. Talk to us about how that kind of enriched your life, too, in some ways.
Sure. Well, any of us who had a college background were given a, quote, white-collar jobs, like usually either in medical department or in the education department. So I was assigned to education, and my job was to help guys get their, well, they had to meet a goal to get out of prison, an educational goal. So for a lot of guys, it was to get their GED or their high school equivalency. For some guys, it was to learn how to read. For some guys, it was to learn how to do eighth grade work. Mm-hmm. So I was working with guys across the gamut, and I'm working with guys the entire breadth of the prison population. So I'm working with guys with swastikas on their arm and stuff like that. And I'm a pretty personable guy, and I don't look down on people who are different than I am or have a different class background than me. And so I got along with people because I was helping them do what they had to do to get out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
it was very good in that. And I met a lot of people I never would have known before. And not that I hung out with them in prison, but I was friendly with a lot of guys in prison because we were all working together on that. So that was important. We did have a group in the prison, though, of like-minded people, both white radicals and some of the African-American radicals, some of the hippies. This was the time of Woodstock, so mm-hmm. we sort of had a sense of solidarity and youth culture, you know, against the establishment. And we had a group we called the Family, and we sort of pooled our resources, both financial, so we could buy things and keep them together, you know, like cookies, coffee, things like that, but also for protection and for friendship. You know, we sort of tried to develop a sense of community in a prison, which is the place that tries to break up any sense of community.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah.
So it was very important for me, and some of the guys from that have been my friends all my life.
Oh, that's amazing. That is really terrific.
It was very important for my both my physical survival and my mental well-being.
Yeah, God, well, what a time that was, too. You know, as I was reading your book, I kept thinking about what a crazy time 68 to 71 was.
Yeah.
You know, all the assassinations, Woodstock, the Manson murders, all this stuff was going on while we were youth. While we were youths, I was in my teens. It was a most unbelievable time. Now, Bruce, you got out on December 23rd, 1970. You say your thoughts about nonviolent resistance evolved during the late 60s. To talk to us about what you came out of prison thinking and where you thought you might be heading.
Sure. Well, you know, I have to be very careful how I talk about this. I decided I was no longer a pacifist. That is, I did recognize certain situations where one might have to use the use of force. But in terms of tactics, I never agreed with some of my friends in SDS who moved into much more violent action.
Oh, yeah, the Weathermen.
I had a good number of friends in the Weathermen underground.
Yeah.
You know?
I had a member of the Weathermen on the show. I had Kathy Wilkerson on.
I despised what they were doing. I thought they were doing tremendous harm to the anti-war movement and not accomplishing anything and just getting a lot of good people in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was out, I opposed that. I also opposed a lot of the Marxist-Leninist sectarians, you know, on the left, because I didn't think they had anything to say to the American people. But I was able to get right back into the movement. The condition of my parole was that I go back to college, which is a pretty funny condition. And I had a choice of either returning to Cornell, where some friends on the faculty had arranged for me to get back in, which must have been some feat given my record at Cornell, both academically and disciplinary-wise. But some others, another faculty member and some graduate students, including one of my roommates, Mike Rothkin, had moved to the University of California at Santa Cruz, which is a new campus in mm-hmm. the University of California system. And that was a campus that promised a lot of individual learning, interdisciplinary work. It seemed the right thing for a guy coming out of prison who hadn't been in school for a long time, coming out with an attitude, coming out really believing in the need for revolution, although I still didn't believe in violent revolution, but, you know, that the society was so corrupt that we needed to have massive changes in it. But they had to be popular changes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, I always thought that there's something that the people would demand and bring about.
Mm-hmm.
But I never, as I said, in terms of violence, I never thought that any kind of violent action that we could do in the movement here would make any sense.
Yeah.
But I did see how countries fighting for their national liberation didn't have any choice in that matter.
You know, I think you've made a great choice going to UC Santa Cruz. I know that school very well, and I know that Angela Davis teaches there. So it's still a school that has all kinds of leeway in regard to people's interests and acceptance of alternative thought, you know.
It was great for me. I mean, I ended up graduating with highest honors in an individual major called American Radicalism in the 20th Century.
Oh, I love it.
So it was great. So, you know, I studied African-American history, women's history, history of the labor movement, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up doing my senior thesis on socialism and women in the early part of the 20th century.
I love it. And that school is still like that. So Bruce, you know what I want to ask you, too, before we run out of time?
Sure.
You say you still believe in democratic socialism. Talk to us about that. How are you feeling about a democratic socialist running for president at this point in time?
I'm pleased to see Bernie Sanders running for president. I support him. I've given money to his campaign. I think that the ideas of socialism make great sense to me, you know, that the idea that capitalism should not just be based on profit, because that leaves so many people out of it, so many people in poverty, so many people with unhappy lives. And a wealthy country like the U.S. should be able to provide for a decent life for its people, you know, whether it be free health care or free education. An end to all forms of discrimination against people, you know, based on race or sex or sexual orientation. I mean, all that things are part of, to me, of a democratic socialist platform or program.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. You know, so I'm thrilled to see him running.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he's going to win, but I think I'm glad he's running and I'm happy to be a supporter.
Well, Bruce, we are almost out of time. Do you have a website or anything anybody can get in touch with you in any form?
No, but if they got in touch with the Cornell University Press, they would forward anything to me. So I'd be happy to. I don't have a formal website. But,
okay, great.
I think Cornell Press at cornell.edu, I think, works.
Okay, well, Bruce Dances.
That would be the way to do it.
Bruce Dances, thank you so much for joining us. This has been such a great pleasure talking to you. Again, the book is called Resistor, A Story of Protest and Prison During the Vietnam War. Bruce Dances, thank you so much, and good luck in the future.
Thank you.
Keep writing.
And thanks for having me on your show.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.